Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And behind me, watching over the union he saved, sits the man who in so many ways made this day possible.
Very emotional moment from Barack Obama speaking from the Lincoln Memorial just 2 days before he became president. Andrea Bernstein filling in for Brian Lehrer. Abraham Lincoln is getting a lot of attention this year, and not just because it's his 200th birthday. Lincoln was sworn in as president with the Lincoln Bible. He started his campaign in Springfield, Illinois. He, of course, held the Senate seat that Lincoln had. The inauguration of the first African-American president in the bicentennial year of the man who freed the slaves, how could there not be an explosion of attention? One man responsible for some of that attention is with me now. Henry Louis Gates Jr. takes a provocative look at that particular aspect of Lincoln's legacy in his new book, Lincoln on Race and Slavery, his PBS series Looking for Lincoln, and the essay he wrote for TheRoot.com, where he's the editor-in-chief, called Was Lincoln a Racist? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Andrea. It's great to be back on the show. I always love this show. It's one of the best on the air. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. And, you know, by the way, many, many years ago, you taught me at Yale.
I was going to say, were you my student?
I was your student, but it was in a lecture course, and it was about, you know, well, a lot of years ago. when Reagan was president in his first term.
The good old days.
I'm proud
of you. You've done well.
Oh,
I'm proud
thank
of you.
Thank you. So you have obviously spent a lot of time thinking about Lincoln, studying him, writing about him, doing this television documentary. What has caused you to want to spend so much time in your life sort of digging up this question of was Lincoln a racist?
Well, I think it's because when I was growing up, there were pictures of two white men on the walls of most black homes. Now, I grew up in Piedmont, West Virginia, which is halfway between Pittsburgh and D.C. on the Potomac River. It was a little Irish-Italian paper mill town, but really it's just typical black homes everywhere. I was born in 1950 so that we can date this. But before John Kennedy was assassinated, if there were any white men hanging on the walls of, you know, their images hanging on the walls of a black home, it would have been Jesus, of course, blonde hair and blue eyes, and Abraham Lincoln. Now, one Sunday afternoon, when I was 10 years old in 1960, it was rainy, and so I couldn't go out and play. So I was going through my parents' library, and remember those Reader's Digest condensed books?
Oh, indeed I do.
Well, you know, they had like five novels in one of the bound volumes, or five books, and one of them was Jim Bishop's The Day Lincoln Was Shot. And I read that, and I'm telling you, it tore me up. I was just engulfed in emotion, and I cried at the end. I mean, it was so sad that the greatest president, the man who had freed my people. Then when I was a senior in high school in Piedmont, we used to get Ebony magazine. That was our lifeline, along with Jet, to black culture down there in the hills of West Virginia. And on the cover was an article by Lerone Bennett, who's now become a good friend. I couldn't have imagined that then, saying, was Abe Lincoln a white supremacist? And we featured this in my PBS film, which, of course, aired on Wednesday, Looking for Lincoln. And I didn't have the scholarly tools to evaluate it, but I thought, wow, you know, there's a whole nother Abraham Lincoln, or at least a whole nother set of interpretations about Lincoln out there. And then at Yale, 2 years later, I read an essay by W.E.B. Du Bois that was published in the Crisis magazine in 1922, in which he said that Lincoln was infinitely more complicated than we thought. I'm going to read you a quote. He says, I love this quote. It's from the May 22nd Crisis magazine, and Du Bois wrote, he was big enough to be inconsistent. And then Du Bois gives these series of oppositions. He was cruel but merciful, peace-loving but a fighter, despising Negroes and letting them fight and vote, protecting slavery and freeing the slaves. Then Du Bois says, he was a man, a big, inconsistent, brave man. I love him not because he was perfect, but because he was not and yet triumph. So 2 years ago, Peter Coonhart, my fellow executive producer of my African American Live series, and whose family has been collecting Lincoln memorabilia virtually since the day Lincoln died, he said, look, I want you to write and host and narrate a documentary on Lincoln. And I said, I don't know anything about Lincoln. You know, what do I know about Lincoln? And I knew just about what I told you here on the phone. So I thought about it, and I thought, you know, it would be like going back to graduate school. It would force me to read all this stuff on Lincoln, figure out his contradictions. I had long been haunted by this essay that Du Bois had written. And it gave me a chance to say, would the real Abraham Lincoln please stand up? And so what we did was we deconstructed Abraham Lincoln, all the myths about Lincoln. And there are many. You know, there are as many Lincolns as there are people. Lincoln's myth is so capacious that when you look in the mirror of Abraham Lincoln, you see yourself reflected no matter what your ideological position is. For example, there's Lincoln the Great Emancipator, but there's Lincoln the White Supremacist, Lincoln the Tyrant, the War Criminal, but Lincoln the Savior of the Union, the Redeemer, Lincoln the Warrior, Lincoln the Peacemaker, Lincoln the Crafty Bureaucrat, and the Brilliant Bureaucrat, but Lincoln the Crafty Politician, Lincoln the Melancholic, but Lincoln the Humorist. There's even a book that says Lincoln is gay. And then there's another book that says he really was in love with another woman, before Mary Todd, named Ann Rutledge. And when she died, it broke his heart, and he only married Mary Todd as the consolation prize. And Mary Todd knew about this allegation and hated the guy who did it. There's a famous poster of the great atheist in the Western tradition with Lincoln right at the center. But for many people, he was the American Christ. Fidel Castro's hero is Abraham Lincoln. So you have Lincoln the Republican and Lincoln the Communist. I interviewed officers in the Sons of the Confederacy, and that's in the film. You know what they told me? They said Abraham Lincoln is the biggest war criminal in the history of the United States, and he should be tried posthumously under the Nuremberg Conventions for war crimes. And his face should be chiseled off Mount Rushmore.
let me ask you, I want to get to the question of will the real Abraham Lincoln please stand up? It's also in your Root essay and sort of, you know, the kind of assumptions behind that endeavor. But let me just first ask you this question, because we sort of, you know, tease people at the top of the show, was Abraham Lincoln a racist? So let's talk about that. And you mentioned, you know, he was a big white supremacist. What are you talking about?
Well, Lincoln was firmly opposed to the institution of slavery. So for us, if you tell someone that, they go, well, how could he be a racist? He was against slavery, and he started the process. Lincoln didn't free all the slaves, but he started the process through the Emancipation Proclamation, which led to about 500,000 out of 3.9 million black people in the South, not in the border states, but in the South, being able to gain their freedom once Union troops, you know, were victorious in the South, and these slaves could run behind Union lines. But Lincoln refused to free the slaves in the border states, which were part of the Union. I mean, many of us don't know that there was still slavery in the North during the Civil War. He was against the institution of slavery, but on moral grounds, because he thought it was wrong fundamentally, a violation of natural rights to steal another person's labor. But also he thought slavery discriminated against poor white men like his father, that poor white men could not compete in the marketplace with rich white men who had the extra advantage of having free black labor. It was a bit like you taking the SATs and competing against somebody who's been given 400 out of 800 points just for signing their name. You know, that's not fair. But that said, he was not for racial equality. In 1858, he gave a speech, which Du Bois cited in his essay, which is a shock to people. And it says, I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, this is Lincoln, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and black races, that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say in addition to this that there is a physical difference between the white and black races, which I believe will forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. Do you know that a month before Abraham Lincoln signed the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, which was on September 22nd, 1862. Now, the Emancipation becomes law on January 1st, 1863. He had a meeting with five black men. There had never been, you know, more than one black man at the White House up to this time. Lincoln had one of his ministers go to the Bethel AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church in D.C., the big sign saying, "Meet President Lincoln." So the church was packed, and everybody's looking for Lincoln, and Lincoln's not there. And this guy from his administration says, "The president wants you people to pick five leaders, and I'll take you to the White House at 4 o'clock. It was a Sunday afternoon. So Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, these five black men walk into the White House. They have no idea why they've been invited. There's Lincoln with the reporter, and that's how we know this story. And you know why he had invited them, Andrea? He told them, "You guys know what the founding fathers are, right? You're like Washington and Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin." He goes, "Yeah." He said, "I've chosen you to be the founding fathers of a new black nation because I'm going to free the slaves, and I am going to encourage all those freed slaves to move out of the United States to Panama, and you will be the founding fathers, and we're going to fund this." And a month before the Emancipation became law, he proposed in his annual message to Congress a constitutional amendment funding the colonization, as we call it, of the freed black slaves, either back to Africa, to Liberia, which had become an independent country in 1847, or to Haiti, which had become an independent black country in 1804, or to this new nation that he was trying to conceive in Panama. Now, Frederick Douglass thought this was the looniest idea that he had ever heard, and all these black people thought it was just totally crazy because they, you know, they were Americans. 75% of all the African slaves had arrived in the United States by the day Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. You know, home was Ohio and New York and Philadelphia. It wasn't Liberia or Nigeria or
Panama
or
City.
Angola.
That's Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr., the editor-in-chief of The Root, the co-host of the PBS series Looking for Lincoln, and the author of Lincoln on Race and Slavery. Phone number 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. So I'm sure that all of this information is sort of, you know, shocking to people who haven't heard it before. But
It was shocking to me.
Is this where Lincoln ended up? I mean, when in, you know, 1865, you know, the war had just ended and he was killed. Where was he on these issues? Had he moved?
No, Lincoln, as I say in the essay, was a recovering racist. The early Lincoln, before he became president, used the N-word publicly in his speeches. He, not as much as Stephen Douglas, who didn't know the word Negro existed. You know, he thought the word Negro had two G's. But Lincoln told darky jokes, and one of his favorite forms of entertainment was blackface minstrelsy. But what happened, two things happened that changed him profoundly. And this is the good part of the story. This is when we recuperate Lincoln. First of all, he met Frederick Douglass, the smartest black man in the world at that time. And Lincoln had never met an intelligent black person. He, you know, some historians, there's a cult of Lincoln among historians. They treat him like they're the disciples of Christ, so they can't ever say anything bad about him. So they say, no, he had some black friends like Billy the Barber and his personal servant, Mr. Johnson. You know, I'm talking about a relationship of intellectual equals. And that was Frederick Douglass, and he fell in love with Frederick Douglass. Secondly, the North was losing the war in 1862. The South was, to everyone's amazement, was prevailing. And Lincoln needed more troops. And where was he going to get more troops? The black, freed black slaves and the free Negroes living in the North. But he told a group of anti-slavery ministers on September 14, 1862, again, 8 days before he signed the preliminary emancipation, that if he armed blacks, they were so cowardly that their arms would end up in the hands of the Confederates, so he was reluctant to do that. But nonetheless, as part of the Emancipation Proclamation, he included a provision that allowed these black guys to fight. Now, black men had fought in the American Revolution. We know that. There were about 5,000, including my fourth great-grandfather, John Redman, a free Negro in what's now West Virginia. But and Lincoln found this out because Charles Sumner, who was kind of like the Teddy Kennedy figure in the Congress at that time, and he was also from Massachusetts, Charles Sumner and a man named William Casemore kept lobbying Lincoln. And they gave him a copy of a book called Colored Patriots, you know, of the Revolution by William C. Nell. And it persuaded him that if the Founding Fathers had done it, he was going to try it. And he was convinced that the margin of victory of the North over the South was provided by these 200,000 black men who fought in the Union military, in the Union Army and Navy. And he called them his black warriors. So here's the punchline, Andrew. Lincoln's last speech of his life, April 11th, 1865. The crowds had come to the White House because the North had won the war, and they wanted Lincoln to make a speech, and they were all on the grounds. And Lincoln finally comes to the balcony. You know, they're chanting, Lincoln, Lincoln. And he comes out and gives a speech, and to everyone's amazement, he says he has decided to give the vote for the first time to black men, some black men. Now, there were 4.4 million black people living in the United States when he gave the speech. So let's say half of them were men. Remember, only men could vote. So there were 2.2 million black men. So Lincoln said, I want to give the right to vote to my 200,000 black warriors. And he said, quote, unquote, to the very intelligent Negroes like Frederick Douglass. So out of the 2.2 million, he was going to give the right to vote to maybe 200,000. Now, you know, not so revolutionary, but it was big. It's the first time that an American president had ever advocated.
Well, I mean, not so revolutionary, you say, but to us now, right? But at the time it was, right? I mean, at the time, I mean, it, you know, and in your essay or your film, now I've gotten it all confused in my mind. There's so much. But in fact, you say Booth was there, right?
Yes, and that's the punchline. Who's standing in the audience? John Wilkes Booth. And he turns to the guy next to him and says, that's it. That means nigger citizenship. And I'm going to run him through. And 3 days later, precisely because Lincoln came out in support of the right of these black men to vote, John Wilkes Booth crept into President's Box at Ford's Theater and shot Abraham Lincoln. So Lincoln gave his life, literally, for black rights. So, you see, he was a recovering racist. He was a man who grew up in the frontier, didn't know any blacks, told darky jokes, but changed and grew. And so Du Bois was right. He was inconsistent, but he was a brave, big man who confronted his own demons and did the right thing at the end. And so he is a hero. And indirectly, Barack Obama's right. Abraham Lincoln made Barack Obama and Henry Louis Gates Jr., for that matter, possible.
Well, and, you know, in some cases, I suppose Barack Obama has made Lincoln possible. I mean, you know, the references, I mean, his campaign just dripped with Lincoln references literally from start to finish.
He's obsessed with Abraham Lincoln. You know, if you've seen that image which we put in the film, which is the merged, I can't remember the artist's name, but it's a merged image of Lincoln and Barack, and it's called Abraham Obama. Barack did turn into Abraham Obama. I mean, he loved Abraham Lincoln. And
well, you see,
that's
a really sort of interesting, one of the sort of fundamental questions which all of this body of work raises, while I feel very enriched to know it all, I'm wondering, you know, to what extent does it matter that, you know, Lincoln espoused these views? And you know, does America need its heroes, particularly right now? I mean, should we be remembering people for everything they once said or where they ended up and what they did?
Good question. And that's why, to answer that question, I took my film crew and we went to the Walter Payton Charter School in Chicago, an advanced senior class, mixed, mostly white kids, but a few black kids and a few Hispanic kids. And they had been studying Lincoln all semester, but in all of his complexity. They had a great black teacher named Kyle Westbrook, who's a big Lincoln man. And so I asked them, knowing everything that you and I have discussed this morning about Lincoln, which these kids knew, what do you think? Was Lincoln still the greatest president? Was he your hero? They loved him more. In the postmodern world of the 21st century, we all know that these myths, no man or woman can live up to mythic status. And these school children, high school kids, seniors, loved Lincoln more. He still was the greatest president. And that's the moral of the story. We can afford to tell the truth about our heroes, and it doesn't diminish them at all.
And we have a caller on just that point, Shakina, calling from Bedford-Stuyvesant. Good morning. You're on WNYC with Henry Louis Gates, Jr.
Good morning. I love this show. I actually went to Spelman College.
Hey, my daughter.
Yeah,
my daughter, Elizabeth Gates, did. Yeah.
Yeah. We ran the same class, but I wanted to say that I think that it's...
Everybody was in everybody's class, apparently, on this show.
I think that it's a generational thing, because I always grew up knowing that there was another side to Lincoln. I mean, always. It was just, and again, I had like really good like black teachers, and it was always kind of a thing where you knew that there was another side, not to take away from anything that, you know, freeing the slaves and all that, but I think that we always grew up knowing that there was another side and that he was a very complex person. So often one is that a generational thing, and kind of the idea of him being put up as this martyr was a way to condense the history into we came over in a boat, freed slaves, Martin Luther King kind of concept.
Right.
And so that's how I learned it, as let's look at it in a broader sense, and that there was, he was very complex, and that he was a product of his time in a way, and some of his ideology. So it's very interesting to hear you say that you went through the process of learning this, and I'm like, well, I've always been taught that there was another side to him. And
were you taught this in elementary school, Shakina? Because my daughter is in fifth grade now and is studying the Civil War, and of course she doesn't always tell me everything that she learns, but I feel like I need to go and ask, did you learn this other side of Lincoln?
No, junior high school.
Junior high school.
I mean, it was a public junior high school, but again, I went to a public junior high school where there were a lot of teachers of color, and I think that that played a role in how they decided to teach us history, because I think they felt like we would be missing, and it wasn't in the books that we were getting. It was them, adding... things that they knew, bringing in other works of literature for us to read. So I think it was more complex, and I think that played a big role in them. And it was a predominantly black junior high school, too. So I think they wanted to kind of give us the full spectrum of
right.
history. So,
well, you see, I'd read Lerone Bennett's essay when I was 18. That was 1968. And I'd read Du Bois in 1970, at Yale. But in terms of explicating his thought, reading everything he ever wrote about race, about slavery, and about colonization, which I analyze in this book that I love, that Princeton's just published, Lincoln on Race and Slavery, which I hope people will read, because I very carefully parse his thought about these three different things. And that's what the surprise was. It's one thing to know a little bit about it vaguely, which is my case. I'd heard these rumors, I'd read these two essays, but to study it for 2 years like I did, and then to go out and film people, that's what led to the series of the discoveries in great detail. So, and it was an education for me. I didn't know any of the anecdotes that I told you. I did not know 2 years ago. I didn't know about his colonization scheme, meeting with the black men, his true relationship with Frederick Douglass. I didn't know he used the N-word and told darky jokes. I didn't know any of that. And I love Abraham Lincoln. I still think
you have a picture of him in your house?
No. Well, actually, I do. I have. That's not true. I have. I'm going to walk to my living room right now and look at it. I have a picture of a lithograph that Booker T. Washington published at the turn of the century. And over his right shoulder is Abraham Lincoln, and over his left shoulder is Frederick Douglass. And they're his two mentors who somehow have given birth miraculously to Booker T. himself. And the headline is Onward. So that, black
people.
So there
you go.
Yeah,
All right, we have to wrap up. Thank you for your call, Shakina. Just one sort of quick question. I mean, you talk in your movie, in the television documentary, to all kinds of sort of, intellectual giants, Doris Kearns Goodwin, Tony Kushner, and they all say, taking on Lincoln was the most terrifying thing I ever did. I'm wondering, was it for you, and how do you feel having come out the other side?
To be able to live with Lincoln's words has just been a great gift. I mean, the man was a genius and had such a command of the English language. And to be able to be... I was told recently that I'm the first black person ever to make a film about Abraham Lincoln. Now, I don't know if that's true, but to be able to set the record straight in a passionate, a dispassionate way, in a calm way, so that, you know, I don't want to beat him up as being a racist, but I just want to tell the truth about a complex man. And I think that knowing his flaws allows us to imagine being Lincoln or being like Lincoln more easily than if he were the Christ-like figure that so many historians have claimed him to be.
And we have to leave it there, but Henry Louis Gates Jr., thank you so much for joining us this morning. We've been speaking about his PBS special, Looking for Lincoln, which you can watch on the web. We have the link on our website. He's the editor-in-chief of TheRoot.com and author of Lincoln on Race and Slavery and In Search of Our Roots, How 19 Extraordinary African Americans Reclaimed Their Past. Thanks for joining us. Conversation continues online at WNYC.org. Click on The Brian Lehrer Show, From Race to Rent, in a moment.